Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some cybersecurity recent headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis of practical application that you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And this week, it turns out that the largest cyber threat this year is T-Mobile compromises, narrowly beating out ransomware. All right, so the first article that we're talking about today is T-Mobile CEO hacker brute forces way through our network. This comes to us from Bleeping Computer. So T-Mobile has been compromised yet again, which is actually the sixth time in the last 4 years. And for those of you who are not aware, T-Mobile is the second largest phone company in the United States. So apparently this hacker was able to get in through what he claimed to be an unprotected router, which he discovered when scanning T-Mobile's IP addresses using a publicly available tool, which is probably like Shodan.
I was curious about what they meant by unprotected as well. Does that mean unpassword protected or using default credentials, or it was just exposed?
Yeah, I mean, that's when he says unprotected, that's exactly what I was thinking, is that maybe they had default credentials on the router and he was able to SSH directly into the router from the outside.
Yeah.
And then use that to target other systems within the network.
I think that he ended up in, I put the note down later, but he ended up in their Washington State data center and had access to around 100 servers.
Yeah, and it took him a week to get to the data that he was eventually able to exfil out of there, the 56 million records. But yeah, of the six times in the last 4 years, one of these was just in February. So just a few months ago, well, relatively speaking. So earlier this year, in which they got similar data as well. So I'm really kind of wondering, if they've had this many compromises in this shorter period of time, what are they really pulling out of their ARs? What are they learning from these compromises that are making them better? Or are they learning anything?
Remember what the lawyer said? The lawyer said don't have an AAR because it becomes discoverable in the event of a lawsuit. So maybe they're not learning anything.
Well, I guess that's the trade-off you have to figure out then, you know. Is it better to learn something or not get sued? I mean, probably, I think that, I guess the decision here is obvious, you know, don't get sued.
Yeah.
Or not necessarily don't get sued, but don't have this as evidence that can be used. It might be one of those things where they're like, well, if we have an AAR, then it's just going to say what the last AAR said, which is what our last pen test report said, which we didn't do anything about either. So we're just going to stop doing those.
Yeah. I mean, that's always the frustrating thing doing incident response, right? Is you see just the same types of compromises over and over and over again. And it is super frustrating. And I imagine that does probably, we talked the other week about what constitutes a liability in terms of things not done. And I imagine having a whole bunch of reports sitting around recommending changes that weren't made probably does constitute a legal liability. Like, oh, look, someone warned you, and then they warned you again, and then they warned you here.
Right. And I think that kind of speaks to maybe the overall maturity plan or strategic plan for the organization, that these findings are not being rolled into some remediation plan. You know, but still, I think it would be better for them to actually change their way that they're doing business to say, all right, rather than simply stopping AARs or stopping pen tests because we don't seem to action those, let's build the team. That's all they do, is remediate the findings from pen tests and fix findings in AARs.
Yeah.
I mean, an organization as big as T-Mobile should be able to have the resources to have that kind of dedicated team, I would think. But speaking of the data that they stole, so basically they stole everything that you would need in order to steal someone's identity. Social security numbers, driver's license numbers, names, address. But thankfully they didn't get the credit card data. So dodged a bullet there, right?
Yeah, I got rid of all the not easily changeable stuff. Great.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, I imagine, and this is complete speculation on my part, is that he could have gotten it, but he's like, yeah, I'm not even going to bother with that. It's not worth it. When you have that other treasure trove stuff that's much more valuable.
I mean, if anything, that speaks to how good the credit card companies are getting these days at shutting down fraud. And, you know, some of my legitimate transactions too.
Yeah.
Speaking of, did I tell you my adventure? I'm leaving this in the podcast, by the way. I tried to purchase a Sands course. Did I tell you about trying to buy a Sands course with my credit card? No. It got my credit card shut down multiple times for fraudulent purchases, even though I had a limit high enough to buy the Sands course. And then they eventually made me send them a picture of my driver's license because they were like, well, when the level of potential fraud is this high, there are special actions that must be taken.
What? Because just because the cost?
Yeah. Because the Sands courses are so expensive now that it was over a certain dollar threshold.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, so I had to push it through the company.
That's crazy. But of course, there probably are a lot of attackers who do take Sands courses.
I mean, as expensive as they are, you can't afford them if you're, you know, living on your average wage in Eastern Europe.
Well, you do if you have a bundle of stolen credit cards.
Yeah, probably have to split it amongst credit cards or something there.
Yeah. I wonder if they get suspicious when they get to card 6. I don't know, but you get those stories about the credit card companies getting the shredded, taped together, pre-approved applications and still processing them. So who knows?
That's funny.
And of course, T-Mobile responded with the standard, there's much work to do, and this is a quote, there's much work to do, and this will take time, and we remain committed to doing our best to ensure those who had information exposed feel informed, supported, and protected by T-Mobile. And, you know, you could almost take this and plug this into all the other six compromises too, because similar statements were made. But it's kind of funny, when I first read this, instead of this will take much time and we remain committed, I read that to say, this time we remain committed. But I think there is something interesting in that statement itself, though, where they say, we're going to be doing our best to ensure those who had information exposed feel informed, supported, and protected. But this goes straight to a Bruce Schneier quote where he says, security is a feeling and a reality. So you can feel secure without being secure, and you can be secure without feeling secure. So it's like T-Mobile in that statement is kind of letting you peek behind the curtain saying, well, it doesn't matter if you really are secure so long as you feel secure. And that's what we want to do, is make sure you feel secure, because that's what they're trying to get their customers to do, is buy into that concept that T-Mobile is protecting your data.
Mm-hmm.
Considering how important mobile phones are to everyone in society now, you know, with your two-factor authentication via SMS or the actual applications like Google Authenticator or LastPass or whatever. You getting your email and your phone and everything. Phones are really becoming crucial to everybody.
Yeah, just to go back to your feel secure thing real quick. I mean, that's got to be the ideal for the companies, right? Like the ideal for the companies is they don't spend any money on security, so there's no real security, but you still feel secure.
That actually reminds me of an old Apple commercial. You remember where they used to have PC and Mac, the two mm-hmm. dudes, you know, the young hipster and the other guy? And there was one when Vista was out where the Mac guy walks up and the PC guy has got two big piles of money. And he's saying, he's putting money into one pile and saying, okay, fix Vista. And then another one into marketing. And then one into fix Vista, one into marketing. And the Mac guy goes, why are you splitting that? You should put that all into one. And he's like, you're right. And he shoves it all into marketing. So it's whichever, you know, cost benefit analysis there. Like, well, we don't have to actually make it secure as long as people feel that way.
Yeah.
Which is sad, but true, unfortunately.
Yeah. Cause every dollar they put into actual security is not actually making the customer feel any more secure because they can't see it.
Right.
Well, that's depressing. Anyways.
So in the notes, you have a statement here about 4 years. Is that long enough to secure a legacy network? Are you saying that the entire T-Mobile network is legacy, or what do you mean by that?
Well,
I don't recall catching anything in the article about legacy.
Legacy is more around the mindset and the fact that their security was atrocious 4 years ago. And the fact that the guy going in now says that security is still atrocious. Now, of course, he only saw one of their data centers. He only saw 100 of their servers or so. So I don't know if his opinion is valid for the whole network or valid. I was just more thinking, like, what happens when you do get that first major breach and everybody realizes that your network is awful and, you know, the blood's in the water? Like, how long does it take to actually get your network and get everything back up in ship shape and, you know, reasonably protected?
Yeah, I think maybe a better way to say that is, you know, how long does it take you to pay down the technical debt which you've accumulated over the lifetime of the organization?
Yeah. Yeah, because if what they're everybody's saying about T-Mobile security is true and T-Mobile never cared and T-Mobile, you know, their security was just absolutely atrocious 4 years ago, how long does it take to fix that?
Well, maybe they did fix it everywhere but there. That was the last data center that they hadn't gotten to yet. But really, 6 and 4 years is kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, and I've got to feel like part of this is because they're skating from major incident to major incident. And I don't know if they're doing a fire drill every time and the whole organization's getting involved and getting pulled off of remediation stuff too. That's a real possibility. And hopefully that's not what their CISO is doing, but could be.
Yeah, maybe it's, you know, we were talking about a minute ago that they should have a targeted team doing these things. What if they aren't doing a targeted team, but saying, okay, we've got a breach now, everyone must respond and move away from this work to focus on breach remediation work. And maybe that means that other technical debt buy down activities are not taking place as well. So it seems like one of the things they probably should come up with is, you know, what's the overall process or what's the plan for doing remediation after a breach? You know, what's the recovery plan look like? And maybe that's where they're really falling down at, is the recovery plan is just not good.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, just having been in security operations forever, I can 100% see that they have this recovery plan. They're getting started on the recovery plan. The next incident happens and it's, you know, 3 months, 6 months of fire drills. And then they come back and they're like, all right, we're doing an after action report. These are the priorities now. And everything that was started before is dropped.
And that's one of the problems with security in general, whenever they're doing projects. And this is, I'm not sure if this is really a major failing on the business side so much as I've seen it so much on the IT and security side, is that they have a project to deploy a product or a solution or to reach some kind of result. But they only do the bare minimum to get it out the door. Instead of saying, this is our goal, this is our expected outcome, we expect to be able to do these things, or this is what marks the end of the project or the completion, or to say that we're successful in deploying this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you roll out a EDR solution, is just getting it installed, is that good enough? Or is getting installed with these types of rules in place or this amount of coverage done, is that when you say you're complete? Because then what you've got is your operations team is getting a complete product versus a product that's not finished yet. And they have to spend part of their time, not just making sure it runs, but trying to get it up to speed as well as where it should be before the project was turned over to them.
Yeah. No, those handoffs are always kind of fraught for sure. So it's usually, in my experience in the past, it's been, hey, we've got this new tool for you. We've finished this thing for you. And it's just kind of tossed over the fence to the SOC. Use it. Have fun. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Right. Because they've got a project timeline that says, oh, we got to get this deployed in 2 months.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Without those kind of checklists in place. And I think also if you actually have a split between operations and projects, that there's no operations people that are part of the project team at all to provide any insight on saying, oh, well, this needs to be done before you turn it over to us. Mm. But this is kind of our guess on what might be going on over there with so many compromises in so short a period of time that they just aren't, they're getting past the firefighting stages. But one of the things that I think also might be an issue here is that just T-Mobile is so large that considering security from a centralized point of view maybe is not the best way to get things done. Maybe a more decentralized approach with smaller areas of responsibility would be more successful. You have smaller teams focused on smaller areas versus having to consider a huge swath of things in order to be successful. This might be a matter of it's just too large and too unwieldy to work.
Yeah, it's the interesting thing there is a lot of companies have been trying to centralize security instead of decentralized. I think wasn't Verizon a couple years ago, they brought in all their kind of, they used to have security down at each of the divisions and they brought it all up centrally. Motorola did that several years ago as well. I feel like there's been a big push in the last decade or two decades to centralize security. It's interesting that, and I don't know, because I don't know how big they are compared to how big T-Mobile is. And T-Mobile probably has some widely differing levels of kind of infrastructure that maybe other companies don't need, since they have to maintain a national or international, set of towers and everything for people to connect to and data centers so people can get their stuff locally.
Right. And then your network has to be huge because of what they provide,
mm-hmm.
Which I think may be one of the reasons why a decentralized approach might be better. And I think that decentralization overall is a better concept. And that's not to say that you shouldn't have some kind of centralized architecture or framework or standards that the decentralized organization must adhere to. And if you're going to do that, I think it's important that you also validate that those standards are followed. So it might make more sense to distribute that out to smaller teams with really good and well-designed frameworks and spend a lot of time on your supporting infrastructure to ensure that those things are being followed with, maybe an actual functional internal audit team or some other method to ensure that those standards are being met or the quality is maintained at a certain level. But why this matters is that, at least from a customer perspective, this is going to happen to all companies. Well, maybe that's a little bit of hyperbole, but this is going to happen to a lot of companies. So the amount of information that an individual provides to companies, you should attempt to minimize that if you can. Because if they don't have your data, they can't lose your data.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that your data is the modern oil. Everything is being built off your data. All the algorithms for the machine learning, the AI is all being trained on your data. They're trying to sell you stuff by your data. The big difference is it's so much easier to steal the oil. And when you steal the modern oil, the data, like the companies still have it. So from their perspective, like they're not losing much when somebody comes in and steals the data because they still have a copy of it, unless it's ransomware. So the financial incentives are just not aligned for companies to protect your data. Like we said, the best situation for them is where you think and you are comforted by the feeling that your data is secure, but they don't pay a cent to do it. If the attackers don't destroy the data and the attackers just copy it, like frankly, there's not really much skin off their back.
Well, I think that's part of the current myth, though, actually, is, we're even saying it in the podcast is your data. It's not your data, though.
That's fair.
It belongs to the company. They have it. They process it. They store it. It's their data. It's about you, but it's not yours.
That's
and,
fair.
I think we've talked about this before, that, you know, Bush and I or others have said that we really need to get a handle on this. So you actually own your data and you yep. allow companies to access your data versus companies owning your data. And once we get to that point, then, you know, this will be maybe even easier to protect.
You know, if there was, speaking of financial incentives, so if you own your data and they are processing your data for you and, you know, they have to pay you a fee, $5 or something. What if they had to pay the person whose data was accessed by an external party? A hacker breaks in and accesses 50 million accounts. They have to pay the, you know, $5 or $10 or whatever kind of the agreed upon fee is for accessing data because they let somebody else access the data. Do you think that would provide enough financial incentive to, I mean, it would, and it would partially recompense you as well, because that's something we're going to talk about later about how they always just give you free credit monitoring, which doesn't really matter.
Right. I agree. That would be a good idea. I don't see it happening personally. yeah. And the reason I don't see that happening, because if you go back in the history of law, it used to be that when you were wronged by a criminal, you were compensated for that, you know. But then the king started taking his portion, saying, oh, well, this doesn't go back to simply the person who was wronged. You also wronged the king. And over time, that has moved towards any criminal activity is actually harming society or, you know, the public, if you will. So all that compensation goes to the government. You know, they fine people.
Hold on.
With the regulators and all that money goes to the government. So I don't see a, you know, at least in America today, where you could pull that off where they would say, oh, well, you have to pay every individual customer $5, where instead they could say, as a regulatory body, we're going to slap a fine on you for $5 million. And you're going to give that to the government. I just don't see it happening.
But it's the fine that they slap on the government. So the fine they slap on is always lower than the cost of having a security program. So that never seems to do much about it. But the other half, hold on though. I've never been the victim of a crime that's required restitution. So if somebody came by and stole my car and then sold it off for scrap and then they caught them and charged them and they were found guilty, they would not have to pay me back for my car?
No.
I've never thought about that before. Holy shit. So if something steals something from you, you're just out it unless insurance covers it.
Right.
What the f***?
Yeah, exactly. But like I said, it didn't used to be that way. But the king started wanting his cut. And eventually over time, that has moved from a percentage to the whole.
I always thought fines were like over and above, like the kind of like how, you know, like if a bank does something wrong, you take away all the profit they made from it. And then you slap them with an additional fine on top of it.
No.
Some bull.
Yes, I agree. Because really you're being doubly harmed because let's say they steal your computer, right? So you're out the computer. You have to buy a new computer to replace it with or whatever. And then they catch the guy and they throw him in jail. Well, I mean, obviously they're probably not going to do that just for a computer theft, but they catch the guy, they throw him in jail. So not only have you lost your computer, you have to buy your computer back, but you're also paying taxes to keep that guy in jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now what they could do is put the guy in jail, put him to labor, and take the expense of his labor and give you the profits from it until you're compensated for it. I mean, there are ways around this. There are ways they could do it, but there's simply no incentive for them to do so when, you know, they're getting all the money now.
And I understand, too, that a lot of the people that are getting caught are the not successful criminals, the ones who are, you know, robbing banks and robbing liquor stores and stuff like that. The really successful criminals are on Wall Street or running companies. So it's completely different.
Yeah, this joke about you want to steal a little money, you rob a bank. You want to steal a lot of money, own a bank.
All right.
But anyway, what you can do about this, and this is from, you know, the organizational perspective versus the private personal perspective. Well, a little bit of both, I guess. But initially, you know, only give out the information you have to a company if you can get away with it. You know, if you don't have to give your driver's license number to T-Mobile, you probably shouldn't do that. You know, only fill out the required fields.
Speaking on that, I had to register my son for the SAT, and they asked him, and they wanted him to sign up for it, not the parent. And they asked him so many questions about just like, where was he planning to do and where is he planning to go? And I was like, this is all the information they're going to 100% turn around and sell to the colleges.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, all the college loans weren't, mostly run by the government. I would think they were selling them to the banks too, but.
I mean, they could be making, I mean, even the, what was it? California DMV was selling its records to.
Oh yeah. Right.
I mean, even the government's getting in on it. Anyways, that's a side topic. It's like side conversation.
Right. So when you're filling out these forms for these organizations, fill out only the required fields and don't embellish if you don't have to. And what you should also do is freeze your credit report with the four major credit agencies. And in the show notes, there'll be a link to a Krebs article where he goes into details about that process. It's changed a little bit since that article was written, because it used to be that you had to pay fees in order to freeze and unfreeze your credit, which there's since been a law passed, which has eliminated those fees. So I think some of their processes have also changed to make it easier and cheaper for you to do these.
Yeah. My credit's frozen. And it's interesting to see how the different credit agencies use it. Some of it, it's very easy. You search for credit freeze, you know, Experian or TransUnion or whatever, and it's right there. It's right up front. And then some of them have completely separate portals you have to sign up for to manage the credit freeze, and it's not there. And when you search for it, they'll try and sell you. They'll be like, oh, here's your credit monitoring freeze thing for $20 a month. So it's not nearly as clear cut as it should be, but it's totally possible. I do it. I just froze and unfroze mine a couple months ago.
Yeah. And if they're asking you to pay a fee, that is not the freeze. It's something else. It's some other monitoring or some other add-on. The freeze and unfreeze should be free.
Totally free.
But at the organizational level, you should give some thought to your data retention policies. Do you really need to keep the records of former and prospective customers forever? Because that was part of that 56 million records, was not just current active T-Mobile customers, but also prospective customers. So I'm not even sure what that means. Did they partially fill out an application? Did they talk to a marketer one time or what? And former customers who've moved from T-Mobile to another subscriber. You should have a data, put some thought into your data retention policy about whether you're going to keep that type of data and how long you're going to keep it for, and whether that data is actually really valuable for the organization to keep it. Because if it's not, definitely purge it. And one of their other compromises that T-Mobile had was of their email vendor. And they were able to get financial and other information out of the email. So consider your email retention as part of your data management as well, as to whether you're going to keep, deleted email at all and active email, how long are you going to keep it? You know, if email is over 2 years, are you just going to purge it regardless of whether it's actually deleted or not? So make sure you consider email as part of your data retention strategy as well. And in the article, they mentioned that the test environment was compromised. So are you protecting your test environment like you are your production environment? Is your test environment protected to your production environment? What are the controls between your test environment and your production environment? Are their credentials the same in the test environment and the production environment? Because I kind of look at it as, if the networks are connected, then you might as well consider the whole thing production. When I worked for the Army, I don't know how many times we worked on compromises where the unit said, oh, it's just a test box, don't worry about it. That was like a huge number. I don't even want to say the percentage, but it was a large percentage of system compromises were for what they called, quote unquote, test systems. And if you're using, like, unfortunately, a lot of people are in organizations I've dealt with before, using production data in your test environment, that's not really a test environment from a security perspective. That's a production environment from a security perspective and should be treated as such. But there are plenty of links in the show notes to some Krebs articles and other references to stuff we talked about in the article. So what's the next one, Matt?
We have another one. I thought we were just done. Dang it. All right.
Wake me when you're over, you know, when you're complete.
So the next one is on China's Microsoft hack may have had a bigger purpose than just spying. And I think David's got some very strong feelings on this one. So I'm really looking forward to this. In terms of the summary, this is basically on the attack on the Microsoft Exchange servers back in March. It was attributed to China. They called it the Hafnium Group, which is a pretty recent group that's only been seen since 2020, I recall. The companies, this was for on-prem exchange servers, and most companies that were still running their own exchange servers at the time were small to medium-sized firms. A lot of people had been moved off to Office 365, so there was not, there was good news there, definitely good news. So the article had a lot of detail on how they did the hack, which was really interesting, but we don't really want to talk about that. What I'm really more focused on here is that when you get to the end of the article, they have a big prevailing theory that they're taking all this information on us and using it to train AI/machine learning systems. For example, they talked about how China has the OPM records, they've got Anthem medical records, they have credit card info, they've got all the credit file info from Equifax. They mentioned Marriott, they had 500 million travelers info from Marriott. Apparently, there were somewhere around 150 companies compromised in various cloud server provider hacks. And I have a quote from Kirsten Tott, who is in the Obama administration and now is working at a private think tank. And the quote is, "There is a long-term project underway. We don't know what the Chinese are building, but what we do know is that diversity of data, quality of data aggregation, accumulation of data is going to be critical to its success."
Oh my God, the Chinese are coming.
I mean, David, while we were talking before we started recording, David did point out, like, if you don't know what the project is, then how do you know anything about the requirements of the data that are going to go into that project?
I mean, how many times have you been part of a project that has a similar statement like this? Has like the how the project is kicked off. You know, they're like, well, we want this outcome, but they don't know what the inputs are. But these guys are assuming an output, or assuming the inputs are going to lead to an output, or are important to whatever they're building. And it just doesn't make, the statement just doesn't make any sense. I think it's just more the fear mongering that the defense industry needs in order to build China as a threat. I'm not saying the Chinese are not doing compromises or hacking the U.S. government or government organizations. Not at all. But I think they're trying to build the Chinese into a bigger threat than they necessarily are, and trying to throw these kind of ambiguous language out there to hype the fear, saying we don't know what they're doing, but it's terrible. I mean, that just kind of states is an indicator of the quality of the United States intelligence. As they're saying, they're doing something terrible, but we don't know what it is. Well, how can you be sure they're doing something terrible? It's kind of like in the 80s during the Reagan administration, that you had all these intelligence organizations running around saying the Russians are so good, we don't know how terrible it is, that, you know, what kind of terrible things they have. We can't find their silent sub fleet, so it must be huge. And it turned out that the Soviet Union was largely a paper tiger and completely collapsed without the intelligence agencies even knowing it was going to come. So I'm really leery about these kind of statements from these government folks about the terrible threat of the Chinese.
So, go ahead.
I want to say in the article, they talk about how an organization at Microsoft called Mystic, and this fancy acronym, which I don't have written down and don't have it off the top of my head, said that they looked at this hack and knew right away it was Hafnium, even though it didn't seem like it matched the Hafnium TTPs, which did not target small and medium-sized businesses. It's almost like they have an answer and shoehorn things in to fit it.
Well, you mentioned the small and medium business size. That was actually my first question on this. Were the Chinese specifically targeting small to medium-sized firms? Was this a conscious target, or was this some thing where they found, if I recall the timeline, there were other criminal groups using this exchange, and then it just blew up one day because the Chinese started using it. Or is this more of like an attack of opportunity, like, you know, going at it with a shop vac, just trying to get as much data as they could?
Well, that was not my understanding. My understanding was that the Chinese were doing targeted attacks, and then the vulnerability came to light. And this is what I remember from the reporting at the time, that the Chinese were doing targeted attacks. Then the patch came out and they were afraid that they were going to lose their ability. So they took the gloves off and started spraying and fraying versus doing targeted attacks. That's what I remember from the time of the reporting. And I think, and this was my assumption at the time, and I don't think my assumption is, or my belief here has changed much over that time, is that the Chinese are doing targeted attacks. And once the gloves came off, once the patch was released, others reverse engineer it. And that's when you got the arbitrary attacks from just everybody trying to pile on before the patches could hit critical mass, or most organizations could get the patch implemented.
Gotcha. I don't know. I don't. Again, I didn't pay much attention. I'm actually pivoting off of. One of the things that I did see in the article was they did say that the attacks increased in scope vastly and forced them to accelerate the patch. So there may have been multiple kind of pivot points on this as well. So, because that does always happen whenever the patch is released, and the attackers reverse engineer it and start going to town.
Yeah, and this is one of those instances where the small to medium-sized businesses, that's who got targeted, because that's who is running an exchange on-prem. Not necessarily because they were small or medium-sized, but that's what they were running.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going with targets of opportunity. Like, they were just there, and the Chinese had this new exploit, and we're like, well, got to do something with it. I don't know. All right. Are they attempting to model the entire populace? I saw in the article that intelligence officials have estimated they've stolen the PII for 80% of the American population. That is pretty impressive. Is there any benefit to having the PII for 100% of the American population?
No, I'm not sure. I was thinking about this, though, is like, they've stolen 80%, but could they have just bought the 80% on the dark web?
Or even legitimately, like, couldn't they have just gone to any of these brokers and just purchased all the information?
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm not sure what you could do with, what a nation state would do with 80% of the PII, the American populace. But imagine this, though. If they do have this, they've got 80% of the PII for the whole country. Imagine they get compromised by a Russian crime gang.
I'm
80% of America.
I'm curious now if it's cheaper to buy the PII in the clear web or the dark web.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's the only difference might be who has access to those markets.
Yeah, who's permitted. Yeah, who's permitted to purchase it.
But if the Chinese have the resources that everyone believes in, they have, as the fact that they're a nation state, for sure they could get those access to those clear markets.
Yeah. So it was specifically stated in the article that they might bump you on a cruise or vacation. I think they meant bump into you on a cruise or vacation.
Yeah, that's a tradecraft term. Yeah. So what they want to do is turn someone who has clearance and access into a double agent.
Yeah.
And they're suggesting that they might do this on a cruiser vacation.
Gotcha. Yeah, I can definitely see where this information would be useful, figuring out, like, you know, who's got medical problems and might need more money, who's been putting all their money on their credit card, going on big, lavish vacations and need some money to fund it, that sort of thing.
But I mean, this also kind of speaks to that secret squirrel mindset. Because if they have all this data on you, why are they going to wait for you to go on vacation? How bumping you at the grocery store?
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that they're still thinking Cold War, Soviet secret spy stuff, where you have to go to Mexico City in order to exchange data and stuff.
Well, it makes for a cooler movie when they come back and make a movie out of your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it works better for the fear narrative because it sounds all James Bondy, Secret Squirrel stuff. You know, sounds fancy.
Yeah. You did put a note in here about what would you get from the American people that you wouldn't necessarily get from a billion Chinese, putting them into the AI. And the answer that is there, and that is so that when Alibaba replaces Amazon as our favorite digital seller and you log in, it's already going to know our favorite things to buy. It's already going to present us with, you need to replace your toilet washing stuff in 1 month. You need dishwashing detergent.
Maybe they'll just buy Amazon. I guess if you can consider that, you know, America is China's biggest market, but they want to sell to Americans. So understanding American preferences is very important to them. So actually, from that perspective, it does kind of make sense. Because when I was thinking about it, it's like, okay, there's 330 Americans. They get 80% of the records from that 330. My math is really crappy, so I'm not going to try to guess at that number.
It'd be 240 plus 24, so 264.
Okay, so they get the 264 records of Americans. And because they've stolen it, that data is probably not complete or maybe partially inaccurate. So if they're using it to train AI, I'm not sure why it would not be more beneficial for them to take records they already have much better access to of a billion Chinese in those same areas for, you know, dentists or you know, those other small businesses that they reference in the article. It just doesn't make any sense to me that it would be worth that effort in order to do that just to train AI.
I mean, unless it's for something that's going to be specifically targeted at us for some reason. I mean, what if they're taking that tradecraft stuff and rather than trying to do it one at a time, they're trying to do it like in a mass method, where they're reaching out to hundreds or thousands of people to turn rather than like one at a time, two at a time, 10 at a time.
Well, if they were doing that, why would they bother just shotgunning it? They've already got the 21 million records for the people who have clearances and their families. Why not identify those based on those records who you want to target?
No. But the problem is they want more stuff than that. They don't want just the military stuff. They also want the high tech stuff and the R&D stuff that the military is not working on, because they look at business and the government differently than we do. We see it as like, oh, this is a military fight. They see it as business and the military all kind of together and all.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, they might be looking for the non-military stuff too.
Okay. So like trying to get a foothold in Apple, or I mean, Apple's already making all their products in China. So China probably already knows most of the stuff about Apple anyway.
Yeah. But all these small and mid-sized businesses, I mean, there's a ton of almost all biotech stuff. Almost all those are mid-sized businesses. So that may be somewhere where they don't have a good foothold yet.
That's a good point. I think that still goes against the idea that they just shotgun it though versus doing targeting.
No, you're right.
Because I have one of the problems that I have with this whole concept is that, you know, they don't have infinite resources. They still have to figure out, or, you know, they still have to put this stuff to use, and not being more targeted still depletes their existing resource pool. The more they do against targets that don't matter, the less they can do against targets that do matter.
That may be where the machine learning thing comes in. Because when we were texting before this, I was joking about like who had the highest debt and you can just use a spreadsheet to figure that out. But maybe you can't figure that out with a spreadsheet when there's 264 million records. Maybe trying to target, maybe the data set's just too big to try and target effectively. And that's what they're doing with the machine, like putting in the previous people they've turned and, you know, what were their financial situations? What were their relatives? What was their background like? And looking for trying to bubble up the highest quality candidates.
So the most likely success turn rate.
Because I mean, if you're looking at 21 million people, like that's definitely one thing to look at. Here's the top clearances, you know, and then with the OPM stuff, you could probably look for the most embarrassing stuff is right there in front of you versus 264 million. Maybe just problem with scale.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, let's move on. Why does this matter? The big thing here is, and this is for me, I think that no company is too small for China to break into. Now, admittedly, with this attack, like we were just talking about, this was maybe more of an attack of of an opportunity rather than specifically targeting individual small or medium businesses. But if you're kind of caught up in it, if you're using one of these products, maybe like a VPN product or exchange or something like that, you may get swept up in it too.
But something else I think you should, that you should think about that is going to narrow this focus down for you a little bit more is looking at kind of like the target reach where that that HVAC company was compromised is, you know, who are your partners and who are your customers? And are they big enough fish where you could get someone who has more resources targeting you in order to get to them through you? And consider that, you know, your attack service might be larger, or, you know, you as a target might be larger than you think based on your associations and not you directly. Because you may not even hold any of the data for any of your partners or customers, but you have some level of access or some level of interaction with those other companies, even if it's only you regularly send them emails because they're used to seeing those emails. They're more likely to trust those emails, which means they might be able to convince someone that an email from your company, which is a fish, is a legitimate email.
Yep. And what can you should do about it? What could you do about it? What should you do about it? Really, the big thing here is you should not, you know, staff up a SOC, especially if you're a smaller mid-sized company. You shouldn't necessarily build up your security program to prepare for the Chinese coming or the Russian crime gangs or whatever. The big thing here and the big lesson from the exchange was a good, fast, consistent batch process. Sure, there were people that were being exploited before the batch process, and monitoring would have helped there if possible. But once the patch came out, like, get it in, get it tested as fast as possible, and then get it deployed as fast as possible.
And if you understand your organization well enough to know what your business critical apps are, there are automated testing applications like the IBM Rational tool that you use to automate testing. So, and that can help you in maybe getting your patches rolled out in days versus weeks. So imagine that a patch comes out for this, for IIS, for instance, and you serve customers via a web page. If you had an automated testing product, you could patch automatically in your test environment or in your development environment, run your automated testing tool against that, which mimics a customer, what a customer does on your site, ensures that your site is fully functional from your customer perspective. If that all passes, you can move that patch straight into production, knowing you've already conducted your testing. And the likelihood of it impacting is going to be low because you've already tested that all out. And if you spend a decent amount of time kind of focusing on that and getting that automated, you can get that your patches rolled out at a pretty high tempo for those critical systems. And maybe you only do that for like internet facing systems, for instance. You just focus on automating the patching and testing of those. And that might be enough for the large part. And maybe, you know, considering that workstations are often targeted right away with phishing attacks, you patch them without even questioning it. No testing whatsoever. Patch comes out, you patch, period. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could do that saying that you have your patch, your workstation patches broken out into two groups. So no 100% of one department would ever get patched at one time. You'll patch, you wait a couple of days, and then patch the second half of the team after that. That patch has been validated for a couple of days during the business week.
All right. So we've got a third fun article for us. Cyber attackers are now quietly selling off their victims' internet bandwidth. We did it. We figured out how to monetize compromised systems. We're done.
Surprise,
now.
Surprise.
So latest method for attackers to monetize compromised systems is using proxyware. Proxyware apparently can be a legitimate application that's used to portion out internet connection to other devices. One of the examples they mentioned in the article, there's actually a service you can get paid by providing some of your internet connection to their proxy users. It's kind of like Airbnb for the internet. And the reason this is important for attackers is this is big for things like credential stuffing attacks. I know companies and especially Microsoft is getting a lot better at noticing when people log into, for example, O365 using a data center IP address and flagging those as suspicious. I know there's a couple companies that actually kind of live with this. They look at all the IP addresses used for logins and for purchases, and they come back and say like, oh, this is from a known proxy service. It might be malicious. This is right. This is from a known data center, you know, watch out for it, et cetera.
Yeah. Versus something like this, which is going to come from looks like Cox Cable.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Fios or whatever.
Now there was another article we looked at for this that we didn't end up pulling in for the thing, but that was one of the things it was talking about is doing stolen credential attacks was they need, they've definitely gone to using more residential, and here we go. So in terms of discussion, I don't know when we're finally going to run out of things that people sublet out for money and people can resell and rent out. But now we're renting out our internet connections. That's fun.
It's part of the sharing economy. Get with it.
One of the things that David pointed out to me, I originally had a list of all the ways that I could think of to monetize a compromised PC. And I came up with a total of 7, with the new proxy thing being 8. And then David pointed out that Krebs had a list from an article back in 2012 on how many different ways attackers can use a compromised PC. And admittedly, they weren't all monetization ways. There were other things such as storing wares and distributing spam and stuff like that. But he had all my stuff there, and I wasted a whole bunch of time coming up with that list. It was really awesome. And I just wanted everybody to know you're not going to get it because Krebs was there first.
As he usually is.
I mean, you're not wrong. But that being said, now I'm kind of interested. I don't know if anybody's done a study on this or not, but I would love to see a study on what the best way to monetize a compromised PC is. There's got to be some, like, you know, ransomware will make you an average of this much, but this many people won't pay, and take all that into account. If you sell it for ad fraud clicks, you'll make an average of this much per hour. I know you can go and you can look up how much you can make doing cryptocurrency mining. You know, I don't think it's much. I was looking up and it's, you can make more than you spend on a good graphics card in a year, but it's not much.
Actually, you know, that would be really good, especially if it were geographically based. And you compromise a box in Kansas, you know, because of the local situation there. This is likely your best outcome. But if you compromise a box in Taiwan, maybe, you know, it's better to do ransomware versus, you know, use it for a bot or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can have your access brokers come up with this, say, hey, I've got access to this. And really, this is probably your best, you know, this is your best bang for your buck to use this in order to do this.
Now, that's who really needs to be doing the study, the people that have the actual dollar amounts. Ones that are like, you know, we'll pay you X number of dollars for 1,000 bots in the US versus Africa. And I can imagine you probably can't get much for ransomware on individual computers, probably a couple $100 per computer.
Yeah, and there are plenty of geeks in that world that probably would do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're listening to this podcast, I would love to see it.
Yeah, I still think Yelp for ransomware should be done first. So you can put Matt's idea on the back burner, but Yelp for ransomware, that needs to be done. That's top of your list.
All right. I didn't have any big discussion points for this one. I just thought it was super cool. And, you know, yet another way of monetizing a compromised PC. Did you have any other discussion points on this before we talk about what to do about it?
Not really.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just cool. Cool little article to finish us off. All right. So why does this matter? Well, it's just awareness of another vector for monetization you should keep an eye out for, because it's new ways that you can identify a compromised system. For example, you can check out these proxyware applications and start watching your running processes for them or block them. If you have any application aware firewalls, you might be able to check through the firewall logs and find some alerts for somebody tunneling out of your own system. Actually, that's something you should be watching for no matter what. That is something you should definitely be aware of. And you may want to watch bandwidth usage as well. If somebody's running one of these proxyware applications, you're probably going to see more consistent bandwidth usage over all of the hours rather than just hours when the user's on them.
Right. So your bandwidth is high at night, you know, or is the same as it is during the day, then that might be an indicator.
Yep. So that looks like all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Psych on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. One day we will have a cool sign off, but that day is not today.
Maybe we could get The Rock to do our sign off or something like that.
Yeah. I'll just call him up and ask.